You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Nathan Goodman, and I'm a senior fellow here at the Hayek Program. Today, I'm joined by Ben Powell. Professor Powell is the executive director of the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech University, a professor of economics in the Rawls College of Business at Texas Tech University, and a senior fellow with the Independent Institute. Today's interview is part of a series we're doing here on the Hayek Program podcast about immigration. Professor Powell has produced an impressive body of academic research, as well as insightful popular commentary on this subject. So I'm excited to be speaking with him today. Ben, thanks for joining me.
All right. Good to be with you, Nathan.
Thanks. So people raise many concerns about immigration in contemporary policy debates, and you've spent a lot of time looking at how economic theory and evidence pertain to these concerns. So in a nutshell, what does economics teach us about some of the popular concerns that we often hear about immigration?
Right. Well, a lot of the, it's not that all economists agree on the desirability of particular immigration policies, but the way we disagree is fundamentally different than what you hear in public discourse about it. Because the public believes a lot of economic consequences of immigration that just aren't there. So like myth number one held pop belief is, that they steal our jobs. Immigrants come in and somehow it has a net job displacement on natives. Virtually no one finds this. The main thing that determines the number of jobs we have in a society is the size of our labor force. The secondary things would be our labor market policies that make it harder to get fire workers, harder to hire workers, things like that. When we add more immigrants, we add more jobs. What we do is we change the mix of the jobs that the native-born population does to better correspond with what's in our comparative advantage. This is fundamentally the same as when we engage in international trade, where people have similar misconceptions about what it does to jobs. And in fact, it destroys and creates jobs roughly equally, but it changes them so that we do the jobs that we're relatively more productive at. And when economists make the case for international trade, either through goods and services or labor, it's based on comparative advantages in us, the native-born population doing what they're relatively better at, suited at doing. But sometimes people think that the job loss is like a negative side of this, but it's part and parcel of it. Without destroying jobs, we don't free up labor to go into those things that we're relatively better at. The churn of the labor market is how we get some of the economic gains from trade, from international trade, and from migration. That's probably the number one one. Number two one probably is, well, they push down our wages because this cheap labor competes with us. Well, cheap labor competes in some sectors, and we have to think of it that we don't have, I was once accused of not understanding economics when I said that, it doesn't, increasing immigration doesn't push down wages. And the person said, what, you don't understand supply and demand? Look, we add more workers, it increases the supply of labor. That must then push down the wages in a supply and demand diagram. Well, very well, that's a start. But immigrants also demand goods and services. So that's going to increase the demand for labor to make those things. Now you get an empirical question going. But two, more importantly, it's not the supply of labor. Labor's heterogeneous. The immigrants aren't exactly like us. So instead, we could think of most Americans, if we think of like the skill sets that we have, most Americans have a high school diploma and some college, though not a college degree. A lot of them have a college degree. A very small percentage of Americans have a PhD or are super, super highly skilled, and a very small percentage of Americans don't have a high school diploma at all. But when we look at immigrants who come in, they're disproportionately very high education or very low education, which means for most Americans, they're a complement, not a substitute. So there's no need for them to push down the labor, their wage rates, and in fact, could push them up. So where economists can find losses is where immigrants are a better direct substitute for native-borns. This is typically high school dropouts. And the debate among professional economists ranges from about does it have no effect to a slight positive effect or up to a negative 8% effect on wages of high school dropouts that are native born. And does it last as long as 2 years or does it go away before that? This is a very narrow range of debate. Like if that's the negative economic consequences on wages, I'm not sure how policy relevant it would be for most Americans if they understood that. These are the long-winded answers. I'll give you one more and then I'll stop and you can redirect. the third big one that Americans have, I think, on economic things is, well, the immigrants come and they're a suck on our tax dollars. They're going to be a net tax drain. And even, you know, economists who I'm sure you, like I, greatly admire, Milton Friedman, had once said that it's just obvious you can't have open immigration in a welfare state. Well, when we actually look at immigrants who come, the vast majority of them aren't a big fiscal drain. Most studies of the overall consequences of the fiscal impact, budgetary impact on the government of immigration, cluster around zero. They're not very big in either direction. And even for low-skill immigrants, if they're young, they tend to be a net tax gain because you get them after their years of schooling and they're working, generating tax dollars, and it gets to retirement before they become a drain. High-skill immigrants, uncontroversial tax gain. Where you see some drains is if it's lower-skill immigrants who are older who come, that will be a net tax drain, but not when you just do immigrants overall. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions about that to it. Even if you have such a misconception, I think there's a, even if that perception was true, there's two ways one could deal with it. One would be radically cut off immigration. The other would be reform what your government spending and taxation policies is to make immigrants a fiscal gain. And you already have this problem with some local communities. While the overall fiscal effect of immigration might be about a net nothing, individual communities sometimes experience a tax drain on schools, policing, hospitals, while a disproportionate amount of the tax dollars generated by the immigrants go national. So that speaks to not cut off immigration, but, you know, redesign tax and spending policy so that you don't create these drains. So I'd say those are probably the three big economic ones.
No, I think that's really helpful because, as you point out, a lot of people have misconceptions around these issues. And so I think it's worthwhile to discuss these issues at length so that people can better understand the consequences of immigration. Related to that last point you made, one pithy way that I've heard, I think your co-author, Alex Narasta, described the better way to address some of the fiscal concerns people have about immigration is build a wall around the welfare state, not around the country.
Yeah, I've liked how Alex says that, although in practice, there's going to be some difficulties with that, particularly if you think about immigrants and their children. You know, I'm in favor of moving to a strictly private education, but as long as we have a public education system that dominates in the United States, if you have immigrants, do you really want to exclude immigrants' children from public schooling? I mean, that's part of the assimilation process that most people want to see happen. So in practice, I like some of Alex's, in theory, I like some of Alex's quote about that, but in practice, I think it's harder. An easier way, given current fiscal arrangements in the United States, and I think probably you, like I, would like to see them change radically, but given what we have, an easier way is just an immigrant surtax. So, you know, let the immigrants in, but give them all a 5% income surtax of immigrant surtax for the rest of your life, pay 5%, no minimums, no exemptions. And for low-skill ones, that's not going to generate very much, but some of them are billionaires and would generate a whole lot in tax dollars. And, you know, 5% might not be the right number. Maybe it's 1%, maybe it's 10%. But when you're someone who's looking to move from Nigeria to the United States and see your income go up by 1,000%, I don't think many of them are going to look and say, oh, it's going to be 995%. Screw it. Let's not go. I guess there's the elasticity of immigration demand relative to a modest immigration tax is almost nothing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I think the point you just made about the enormous gains that people can see to their wages when they immigrate from a poor country to a rich country really illustrate the scale of the gains from trade that we can experience if we allow more immigration. So could you elaborate a little bit on what those gains from trade look like?
Yeah, this is something I think even lots of social scientists and other disciplines underappreciate that economists have estimated, is that moving from a world of completely restricted migration or mostly restricted migration that we have today to one of, I'll call it unrestricted migration. I don't like the term open borders. Maybe we should use the term Ellis Island immigration, which basically means you can do a qualitative check for criminality, terrorism, contagious disease, but otherwise we're not going to restrict quantities. Moving from today's policy to that would increase global incomes by 50 to 150%. So like a doubling on average of world output. This is just massive gains. And a big part of it isn't, so when I started, I talked about comparative advantage and immigration being like trade. A big part of this is not just that, it's what we call the place premium. And this is what you were alluding to from the big gains from moving between countries. And it's, you know, for anybody listening, if you're sitting in Western Europe or the United States listening to this, imagine we plucked you out of your country and dropped you in Haiti right now. consider how much money you'd be able to earn in Haiti, how productive you'd be able to be creating value for others. Not very productive. Well, the same is true for Haitians who live there. Allow them to leave Haiti and come to the United States or Western Europe, and all of a sudden, what human capital they have, which may be modest compared to listeners of this podcast, they're able to make much better use of it. As a result, a Haitian, like a Nigerian, when they move to the United States, sees their income go up by 1,000%. And that roughly reflects how much more productive they become once they're in an environment with a better rule of law, better property rights, a greater margin of economic freedom, more human capital to interact with, more physical capital to interact with, better technology. The gains are so huge because such a huge portion of humanity lives in places with, let's call them crappy governments that make it really hard to make use of whatever human capital you have. So this place premium drastically boosts global output and drastically increases income to immigrants.
I think that's a really important point and one that is underappreciated by most people who haven't looked at the economic literature on this. So most of what we've discussed so far is stuff that economists, regardless of their methodological approach or which broadly conceived schools of thought they're sympathetic to, would agree with. But one thing that you've written on that I really appreciate is how insights from Austrian economics can illuminate our understanding of immigration. So what would Austrian contributions to the economics of immigration look like?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it comes from our understanding of capital and the economic calculation problem, that Austrian insights in this area have probably been under applied in labor markets, and in particular, the international labor market or migration. And I talked about this to the Society of Development of Austrian Economics, gosh, I guess maybe 10 years ago, about some of this. So I'd say two things. So one is the impossibility of having an efficiently planned migration control system. So the United States, you know, we have various categories, H-1B, skill visas, farm visas, family reunification, lottery. Like, what's the right mix of these different visas? No one knows. And it's precisely because we don't have a market for it. Now, no one really claims, I think, that the United States is an efficient migration system. But I have seen that claim made about Canada and other people who manage the migration system, and they look at how many jobs in this industry, what's the educational profile and the language profile. You know, Canada, you can go on their website and see if you're allowed to migrate. Last I checked, I wasn't allowed to, but it matches you up on French and English speaking, relatives in the country, what your degree is. I'm the wrong type of doctor. If I was a doctor who could cure people, then that could have got in, things like this. I've heard other economists who are in favor of these managed migrations say, oh, the Canadian system, it works. Like, well, it works as in it lets in who it says it's going to let in. But like, what's the pretense of that this is somehow an efficient system? We think our government central planners know exactly how many people should be admitted to what industries by just looking at job availability and such. No, we need prices. If you're going to manage a migration system, which means have a quantitative restriction, whatever that quantitative number is wrong. So Austrian economists would be able to tell you the only way to find the right number of immigrants is basically internalize the costs and benefits of moving and of hiring immigrants so that you can evaluate job offers in other countries and your local circumstances, whatever subjective values you have to a particular geographic area, and then decide to move or not move. This is roughly how we do it between U.S. states, where there are differences in the welfare state between U.S. states, but they're probably relatively small relative to what economic opportunities are. We basically get something close to efficient migration between states. And it can radically change, as we've seen, when government policies change, like during COVID and the mass migration from very restricted economic states to places like Texas, Florida, North Carolina, other places where interstate migrants moved in rapidly. And same is true internationally. But if you're going to restrict the number, we don't know the optimal number. But then conditional on restricting the number, and Austria would say the only way you could most efficiently allocate those permits is a price system. And this isn't uniquely Austrian because like Gary Becker has talked about using an auction market for immigration permits. But if the number is going to be whatever the number is, 5 million permits, 1 million permits, 10 million permits, take whatever the number is, divide by the number of business days in the year, auction off that many permits every day. If you want to reunite with a family member, you're free to bid for it. If you're Microsoft and you want to hire an engineer, you're free to bid for it. If you live abroad and you want to buy your own permit, you're free to bid. This is the only way that we can reconcile subjective valuations in someone's head of reuniting with their aunt versus Microsoft's need for a software engineer. So I think that's something that Austrians have unique to kind of contribute to this. Although it's consistent with what like Becker proposed, but it's a little bit more explicit in like why. Another part of it would be that the current migration restrictions distort our capital structure in the United States, both our human capital structure and our physical capital structure. So a lot of people will say things like, oh, well, you know, high-skill immigration is okay, but this low-skill immigration, I don't know about that. And I kind of look around and I say, well, I've been to a lot of other countries in the world and see how things go there. It seemed to me like relative to the rest of the world, our supply of low-skill labor is really scarce. And how do we compensate? Well, we still have low-skill jobs that need to be done. But what we do is we either have high-skill people doing them or we create capital to make the high-skill person more productive and more efficient in doing the low-skill activity. So our restrictions on immigration cause us to not have enough people for agricultural labor, to be nannies, to help raise children, to help do household cleaning, the types of tasks you see in poorer countries around the world, low-skilled people doing all the time, for people who earn a lot less than U.S. median incomes. And in the United States, what do we do instead? Well, we have riding lawnmowers, where you can ride around your lawn very quickly and efficiently mowing it. You have dishwashers. You have so many different household cooking appliances to magnify the productivity of the people who are living in the house who have to do their own low-skill tasks. Capital is scarce. If we had more low-skill labor around, less capital would have gone into those things. The dishes would still get done and would have more capital to go into other lines of business where we could be more productive. And when it comes to childcare, particularly, this distorts the human capital market. And a lot of it's done by high opportunity cost, high skill people. Now, some would be done for subjective value reasons of wanting to raise your own children anyway. But as anybody in their late 20s or 30s knows who as a kid, if you look at the cost of childcare, this can be a major consideration when choosing to have a child if you try to stay in the labor force. And there's lots of parents who exit the labor force who are otherwise college educated and have high skills in order to provide the relatively lower skill service of basic care for child. So that's also impacting like our human capital structure and what it's doing in the United States. So I think that both the human capital and physical capital heterogeneity is something that Austrians can emphasize, and that it's not just about creating more human capital or physical capital. It's about creating the right capital in both cases that best match the existing capital stock in the country. And if we're going to distort the migration market, we're going to distort both of these, and that's going to leave us less efficient, less productive. I think that's something probably unique to Austrians that other schools of thought don't contribute on this.
Yeah, absolutely. So the core point here is that the best mix of human capital and physical capital, the best capital structure, is something that we need to discover. And immigration restrictions directly impede that discovery process by forcing people to not be able to experiment in the way that they would if they were free to migrate and to make contracts with immigrants and with natives.
Right, exactly. You're not harnessing the entrepreneurial imagination to help us discover this. Instead, you're stifling the discovery process.
Exactly. Now, given this Austrian perspective on immigration, it's worth asking what other economists in the Austrian tradition have written on the subject. And you've published a bit on Ludwig von Mises' views on immigration. So how did he think about immigration, and how can economists today and perhaps policymakers today address the concerns that he raised in his own work on the subject?
Yeah, so Mises obviously is a central figure for anybody who's interested in Austrian economics. And I don't want to do like biblical analysis here of what did Mises say, and that's the... But I do think it's useful to look at what he had done on it, which, by the way, in terms of the magnum opus and human action, he says very little. I think there's 4 or 5 pages about international migration in there. It's his earlier work on nation state and economy and liberalism. Particularly liberalism, where you can see more of it hashed out. And, you know, it's kind of 2 parts to it. One is what I'd call the narrowly economic part. And the narrowly economic part, he's like, this is part and parcel of market economy and trade and fundamental to it, and not any particularly different than international trade in goods and services. Free labor mobility is part of the market process, and that any impediments to this are going to cause humanity to be spread on the wrong parts of the globe in such a way that overall our productivity is lower. You know, he doesn't use an efficiency argument per se, but whether he's talking about the common weal or the general well-being, basically the overall production is going to be lower if you restrict migration the same way as if you restrict international trade or international capital mobility. That's step one. But step two for him is there's kind of this insolvable economics or problem with immigration that's outside of its narrowly economic consequences. And he says, if we just had, in Mises' view, what he views as the minimal state that provides the framework and everything else is non-interventionist, there's no objection to immigration. He even gives examples of if Australia fills up with Japanese people, but they can't vote to change the economy and they just interact economically, it's like, who can object? It's going to make productivity go up. What he had more reservations about, and it was really along the lines of, he talks about like nationalist majorities. And if we have an interventionist state and you can turn the course of power of the state against minority groups within the state, you kind of have had a majority view of this, of just like whatever the majority wants to do, that's what you're going to empower the state to do, which I don't think is quite right. But either way, it's fair enough for what we're doing here in immigration. His fear is if too many immigrants from one place come into one country and become the national majority in a country that was previously more successful, but still interventionist, they could turn the interventionist state on the domestic population. And this would be, I think he says, terrifying or something like that. He says the way to solve this would be to have a non-interventionist state, and then that's not a big deal. But given that we have interventionist states around the world, he never really comes back and solves this one for himself. He kind of leaves it hanging of like, the economic gains are clear. There's a political problem. If we have interventionist state, what if they come in, become the majority, take control of it, turn it against the natives? That'd be a reason to oppose immigration, despite his otherwise cosmopolitan kind of view of it.
Yeah. And so the conundrum that he's raising is in some sense a proto-public choice type concern about immigration. And you've written a bit about a set of public choice concerns that relate to the actual implementation and enforcement of immigration restrictions, specifically the rent-seeking costs that can develop when you have restrictive immigration policies. So why might we expect there to be rent-seeking that would result from immigration restrictions? And what does that rent-seeking look like in practice?
Yeah, so that's a little bit different than Mises. Mises actually is going to come back, and I think we'll come back around to this when we talk about the new economic case for immigration restrictions. That's actually got more similarity to Mises' one, although in practice what Mises is applying is there's going to be a rent-seeking battle between the immigrants and the natives. But that's more through changing the interventions to exploit the new minority in the country versus what we see today in rent-seeking battles over immigration. And by the way, trade, same thing. What we're seeing in the United States with this crazy trade war that's been started up is, you know, one step in one direction, a reversal. Oh, this company is going to have an exemption up to this quota, this country. It took a policy of not free trade, but of freer trade. It turned it into a giant political rent-seeking game of everybody who wants a restriction somewhere gets a special exemption somewhere else. And this is good for the politicians. But in immigration, we already have this of lobbying to get which type of visas through the vast immigration legal network we have in the United States of the immigrants trying to work their way through the system legally. Those are all rent-seeking costs to the current system, not to mention all the political battles that have been fought over how to reform immigration policy over the last 20 years that have got us almost nil on real reform. And for that matter, the rent-seeking costs also still go on down at the border. And what enforcement costs are there for? These are, you know, similar to Tulloch's old article of the deadweight costs of monopolies, tariffs, and theft. We see the version of it's a quota rather than a tariff, and the crime aspect of immigration as part of the spin-off rent-seeking costs of this.
Absolutely. So what you just mentioned briefly, while clarifying your answer, was the new economic case for immigration restrictions. That you mentioned rightly has a lot of parallels with the concerns Mises raised. So what's the new economic case for immigration restrictions? What are the arguments that are being made by proponents of this case?
So for the record, I think this is actually the most important potential objection to unrestricted mass migration, if it empirically would bear itself out. Which itself is a different question we'll get into. But this new economic case for immigration restrictions is probably most associated with George Borjas, maybe Paul Collier. And what it basically says is, well, okay, this gains from immigration that we talked about earlier, but these people are coming from dysfunctional countries whose their productivity is low. That's why they're moving. And their dysfunction in these origin countries is at least in part caused by the formal and informal institutions that govern economic exchange in these countries. And those formal and informal institutions, at least in part, reflect the culture and beliefs of the people who are there. So if lots of them move and they bring with them whatever beliefs were responsible for those formal and informal institutions, then the destination country's institutions start looking more like the origin country's institutions. And now, instead of having your doubling of a person's income when they move from a poor country to a rich country, it doesn't go up that much because they've brought down the productivity of the destination country. But even worse, all the natives in the destination country just became less productive. And now, instead of talking about 50 to 150% of global income, these numbers go either way down or even could turn negative. Let me make a concrete example to make this clear. Cuba's poor because Cuba has a socialist economic system. If Cuba's socialist economic system is at least in part the reflection of the beliefs of the people there, and Cubans mass migrate to Florida and recreate Cuban socialism in Florida, not only do the Cubans who move don't get a big income gain, the existing Floridians all become less productive, and this could make Florida on net poorer. Now, I use that case intentionally. I can think of no greater anti-communist social voting bloc in the United States than Cuban immigrants in Florida, which tells you that the empirical case here is that the Cubans who are moving to Florida are not the ones who believe in socialism, quite the opposite. It's the ones who hate it and rebel against it. But that's the idea of the new economic case for immigration restrictions. And really what's new about it is it tying it into the global gains from immigration, because the core of the objection is one that's been around for ages. It's kind of implicitly what Mises is saying there, except Mises is saying, if there's an interventionist state, they could use it for bad things against the natives. This is saying they might take a less interventionist state and turn it into a more interventionist state through their political or informal influence. But you can also go back and read founding fathers in the United States of Thomas Jefferson, of Ben Franklin, worrying about immigrants bringing with them the beliefs imbibed in their youth. And Jefferson says something like, they'll either bring the political beliefs imbibed in their youth or exchange it for an unbounded licentiousness. He's like, it would be a miracle if they stop precisely at the point of temperate liberty, is what he called it. But you can see Ben Franklin saying it about Germans too and different things throughout time. It was an idea that the liberty as believed in by founding fathers would be eroded by immigrants coming. It just that wasn't attached to economic gains necessarily. So that new economic case for immigration is using a cultural objection that's existed for at least throughout the United States history in our context, and now tying it to the estimates of gains from immigration. And I think, unlike most of the other ones, if they steal our, like, if they depress wages, okay, is this a real big game changer when we're talking about doubling global output? Probably not. If they're a fiscal drain, if crime goes up, if you're talking about doubling global incomes on average, you got to be pretty uncreative to not come up with ways that some of that doubling of global income could address whatever problem there is. The big problem here, and why I think this is the most important objection, is if this one is true, well, then you're not doubling global income, which in fact you could be decreasing it. But even if you weren't decreasing it, but you shrink the gains, all those other problems, and there are other transition problems with mass migrations in terms of crowding, slums, dealing with crime, dealing with lots of different things, they become much more binding if you don't have a massive economic gain from the migration. So that's why I think this is the most important social science question surrounding immigration.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like it very directly takes the argument that we make for why the gains are so big and turns it on its head, right? It takes, for instance, your example about if we moved you to Haiti, you'd become much less productive, and says, well, what if immigration turns your surrounding environment into Haiti or into something much closer to it? So I think you're right. It's a very important question. And it's a question that you've addressed very thoroughly, along with your co-author, Alex Narasta, in your book, Wretched Refuse, The Political Economy of Immigration and Institutions. So how did you work to empirically test this new economic case for immigration restrictions?
Yeah, I like the Economist magazine reviewed our book and they said, Paolo and Narasta test this idea as rigorously as they can. And I laughed, and it was kind of a backhanded compliment. I'm like, yeah, it was the best we could do. But it is an imprecise answer to an important question. You know, in like modern empirical economics, the state of the art is asking a narrower and narrower, less important question and precisely answering it. And this is what we did on this is the opposite. We took what we saw as a big question and we said, we're going to do the best we can to get answers for it. But the way the data in the world is messy. So the last chapter even says there's no QED here, but here's how we think about what the overall evidence we find is. So we address this kind of two different ways, because the new economic case for migration restriction, as I said it to you, is very kind of generic in how it's not, there's not a smoking gun of this is the channel through which it happens. It's all these kind of formal and informal institutions that could be happening through them. Okay, so now we have to try to operationalize that to examine it. So we did two basic methods. One is look at existing stocks and flows of immigration across a broad cross-section or broad panel of countries, and look at this over like a 20-year time period of how institutions change when you either have greater inflows of migration or when you have, whether you have greater initial stocks of migrants. And then we're going to say, let's look at institutions, formal or informal, that could be associated with productivity that we can measure across these countries. So economic freedom of the world. So this index, I'm sure many of your podcast listeners will be familiar with it, but we're measuring economic freedom across five broad areas: size of government, security of property rights, freedom to trade internationally, regulation, and soundness of money. And this economic freedom package has been associated, has been used in hundreds and hundreds of papers, generally associated with good developmental outcomes of higher GDP, higher growth, et cetera. So we use that one. We look at corruption. We look at rates of terrorist attacks and the damage caused by them. We do a little bit with trust and deep root stuff too, although I'm probably less thrilled with that stuff. These are all across big cross-section of countries. It punchline here of what we find, like economic freedom generally is actually greater stocks of immigrants are usually associated with bigger subsequent 20-year improvements in economic freedom. So the new economic case for immigration restriction would say economic freedom goes down. But now we actually find not only does it not do that, it tends to go in the other direction more times than not, which means actually those global gains from immigration, if this is true, are understated. Because then we should get even bigger gains from institutional improvement as well as from the straight up place premiums of people moving. I think, and we can't, our data doesn't speak to mechanism specifically, but my kind of intuitive grasp of what's going on with this is it's selection bias of who moves. The people who move don't accurately represent the institutional beliefs of their origin country. And to some extent, they're picking their destination country to better match their beliefs, or they might even be more enthusiastic about it than the people in their destination country in some cases. And by the way, maybe I'll talk about this economic freedom one for a little bit first, and then we can move on to some of the others, because we can also see people talking about it in the United States. And this will help make it more concrete for people. I'm sitting here at Texas Tech University, and in Texas, plenty of Texans worry about all these Californians moving to Texas. And they'll, you know, say it's going to turn us purple. And so, yeah, no. So turns out when you look, listen, if you are in California and you want to leave just because of the high cost of living, you got 48 states to choose that ain't Texas. Texas is kind of a thing. If you're choosing Texas, it's probably because you like something Texas. So turns out, when you look at how they, I don't like Republican and Democrat as good proxies for institutions, but whatever, it's what we can measure right here. Turns out non-native born Texans vote for Republicans at a higher rate than native born Texans do. When it comes to gun ownership, non-native born Texans in Texas own guns at a higher rate than native born Texans do. The people who are moving want to be more Texas. Hell, I moved from Massachusetts to Texas. I run the Free Market Institute. I guarantee you my pro-market beliefs are stronger than the average Texan and better, but still better aligned here than they did in my origin state of Massachusetts before I moved. And it's not that immigrants don't bring culture with them. Like, you know, go to Austin and you'll see more wacky California shit than you used to in Texas. Austin's always been weird, but in general, you know, they might bring their avocado toast with them, but it's not their political beliefs of California that they're bringing with them. Sometimes this is different when they self-sort to go to other places, like when Californians go to Washington State or Oregon or Colorado, but this is selection bias of who moves where to better match their beliefs. And I think we see this to some extent on the international migration margin. That's what we pick up in some of the economic freedom data. Corruption's another one we look at. There, we don't see any effects, really. It doesn't matter. Immigrants don't increase or decrease corruption in destination countries. My read on this is they just assimilate. So if you come from, and we do this from more corrupt countries, poorer countries, we cut it up all sorts of different ways. It basically, my read on it is, if corruption pays, then you engage in corrupt acts. If you move to a country where corruption doesn't pay, you culturally assimilate and you don't do so much of it. And that's why we don't really pick up an effect. I remember when I went, so I don't know if you mentioned in my introduction that I got my PhD at George Mason. And I remember when I was going there, a woman who was going to school with me there had moved from Russia. This is in 2000. She got pulled over on the way to class one day by a police officer. And she just held a $20 bill out the window. And you can imagine what the police officer's reaction was to this. She indignantly huffed, reached back in her wallet and took out a second 20 and said, not enough. And she arrived at class a bit flustered, as you might imagine. I promise you that she never did that again. It was like, oh, I had moved from Russia. This is how I'd handle it here. Oh, try that in the United States. This works out poorly for me. Don't do this anymore.
Yep, it's a learning process.
Yeah. So, you know, we do these various cross-country studies. And in the end, what we basically say is that we don't find any evidence supporting a general finding that more immigration, either a stock or a flow, erodes the institutions that we studied that are associated with greater productivity or better developmental outcomes. But these are all cross-country studies and have various drawbacks of cross-country studies and benefits. One of the drawbacks in this particular case is that it comes from a world of managed migration. All of the data points come from existing stocks and flows of migration, which have quantitative and qualitative restrictions across all of these different countries on it. So it's not that it tells us nothing, because like the stocks and flows we're looking at vary in these countries from almost zero immigrants to like 90%+ of the population being foreign born. So there's a huge variance here, but it is still coming. Maybe the one that has 90% foreign born has that because it works good there and it wouldn't somewhere else. And somewhere else where it wouldn't work well has the type migration. So because it comes from managed migration, it can only tell us within this relevant range what's going on, which is better than knowing nothing, which honestly, the new case for immigration restrictions is a hypothesis in search of evidence, not something that evidence was given for. And this tells us at these levels of migration, what does this kind of relationship look like? And it says non-existent or positive, not negative. So that's a start. But what it doesn't say is, what about, in fact, I had shared this paper with George Borjas when I first got it published and said that his work inspired it. And he wrote back basically like, yeah, your study has all the cost and all the benefits of any cross-country study. What I'd like to see is a large exogenous shock of mass migration and what that does to these institutions. And while I'm reading the email, I'm thinking, well, duh, let's look at Israel. Like economists who study immigration have looked at Israel for mass migration shocks, for labor markets, for housing stuff, for fiscal impacts, for all sorts of things, but no one's done it for the new economic case and institutions. And the reason why is Israel, basically, since it became a country, has had what it calls the law of return, which allows worldwide Jewish people, children of Jewish people, grandchildren of Jewish people, and non-Jewish spouses of all of these people to migrate to Israel and come in with instant access to full citizenship, including voting rights and access to the welfare state. And it's always had this policy. So it's not a country changing its policy in response to when it would be beneficial. What happened, the change, was that in 1990, the Soviet Union's emigration restrictions, preventing people from leaving behind the Iron Curtain, they went away. And there was a large ethnic Jewish population within Russia who instantly had access to be able to escape and migrate to Israel. They did, and as a result, the population of Israel went up, I believe it's 20% in the 1990s, heavily on the first three, 4 years of the 1990s when the mass migration was occurring. And when I was reading this, the first thing I did is I just pulled up the Economic Freedom Index and said, what happens to economic freedom in Israel in the 1990s? Boom, you see a big increase in it. It goes from like something like 30% below the global average to like 20% above the global average in economic freedom. Because of course, the 90s is a time where everybody, not everybody, most countries are increasing economic freedom significantly, right? This is the end of the Cold War. You're getting the end of history here, the move towards liberalization and global markets. But Israel's doing it at a much more rapid pace than everybody else, going from below global average to above. So this one we studied more in depth as a case study, and we did an empirical method of a synthetic control where you basically create a fake Israel that does institutional evolution just like real Israel before 1990. Then we see, does that one increase in economic freedom too? First, the real Israel, and no, the real Israel is what where the big increase in economic freedom is. That's a statistical causal method. But really, sometimes if you just read the text, you can see what the hell's going on here. Like in reading about the Russian immigrants joined existing political parties, formed their own political parties, were part of the ruling coalition government by the, I think, 1996. And this is at a time when the Labor Party and the more right-wing party at Israel were basically neck and neck in the polls at the beginning of the 1990s in terms of power. And when you look, like reading the sociologists, the Labor Party stopped using the color red as they traditionally had in their elections because they didn't want to alienate the Soviet vote. It's like the Soviet migrants who were coming with a 70-year history of no political freedom, no economic freedom, they were wanting to create the opposite of that where they were moving, not recreate Soviet socialism there in Israel. We do a similar case study for Jordan, where through unique parts of their immigration system, people displaced by Kuwait War I could have instant citizenship and impact electoral politics. They had about a 10% surge in their migration, also significantly increased economic freedom. We look at U.S. history and argue that when we have more mass migration to the United States, government growth is more limited. In our biggest closed border time between the early 1920s and 1965, that's where you have your biggest growth in the rate of government intervention in the U.S. economy. We don't have strong causal claims here, but just historical evidence about the pattern. And we do talk about the mechanism a little bit. And actually, this is kind of funny. This will probably be the first on a Hayek podcast that Marx gets favorably cited. But there's correspondence between Marx and Engels in the 19th century complaining about how mass migration to the United States is undermining the ability to fuel a socialist movement here, despite the fact that socialist ideas came from a lot of immigrants in the United States. But what they were doing was the institutional mechanism to promote it politically was the labor unions. And mass migration undermined the strength of the labor unions as new migrants were continuing to come in and undercut them. And Marx and Engels are writing back and forth how this is awful for the spread of socialism in the United States. So there's your probably first ever favorable Marx citation in a Hayek podcast. So we get done those, and there's a different question with these. The cross-country ones, the question is how generalizable are those results to bigger mass migrations that aren't controlled by policy? The mass migration ones, the question is, what's the external validity of them? So, okay, those countries had mass migrations so that you can study them. You can look at what happened. It didn't erode the institutions, arguably improved them in all three cases. But could there be other cases where it would... And this is why I say there's no QED at the end of our book on this. It's, look, we take what evidence we can across countries. We take what evidence we can from mass migrations. We don't find any evidence supporting the new economic case for immigration restrictions. We often find the opposite. And that means like our baseline economic analysis that there's massive gains from immigration, I think should remain in place with the caveat that there could be exceptions where, you know, our results don't rule out any bilateral flow that could be negative and have the type of consequences that like Mises pointed to or that the new economic case for immigration restrictions say.
Fascinating. So it seems like the book can be understood as an invitation to inquiry and a start to a broader research program on thinking through the institutional effects of immigration.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And we also play with ideas in the end where I said there's no QED here. So, and I think some Austrians and libertarian types in particular who are very pro-immigration need to think seriously about this too, because I got a reaction a couple times from when I was presenting stuff from that type of audience that didn't like it when I said, well, what if the data came out the other way? I mean, it would cause me to rethink what my optimal number of immigrants would be if it destroyed the institutions that protect freedoms and productivity in destination countries. Wouldn't it influence yours? And if not, why do you care that I'm doing this research at all in the first place? Just to justify your prior beliefs? So we play with an idea of if we did identify particular bilateral flows that did erode the institutions related to productivity, what would be the type of response most consistent with still securing the gains that you can get from immigration? And you know, I think almost every objection to immigration, people want to radically jump to, so we close the border. So we'll use a concrete example because people are familiar with it. I don't believe there's any evidence for this, but we'll just use it for the sake of an example. You know, Hispanic migration from Latin America to the United States is relatively high. What if they started to become a majority and influence policy views in a way that made us look more like Latin American countries? Well, their answer would be to restrict immigration quantitatively or qualitatively or both from Latin America. But that says nothing about what migration policy between Africa and the United States should be, from Southeast Asia and the United States. And in fact, Latin American migration to Europe is very small. If European countries remained open to Latin American immigrants, many of them would move there instead of the United States. In that case, they'd secure roughly the same economic gains, a little bit less than the United States, but a lot of it. Meanwhile, we have very little Middle Eastern, North African immigration to the United States. Europe's got a lot of that. If they were having a problem with that, they could quantitatively and qualitatively restrict that. Meanwhile, the U.S. is open to receiving those immigrants who are a smaller portion of our population. You secure roughly the same gains from trade. These would be like national defense examples, exceptions to free trade rules. Free trade's the rule. If you find a particular thing that it doesn't lead to optimality on, you don't therefore say no trade. You say, how do we address this one particular problem in this one particular country, which doesn't generalize to all countries? So just because, you know, landlocked Lesotho in South Africa, inside South Africa, can come up with something that it should restrict for national defense doesn't mean it would apply to the United States, which has a massive navy and two coasts. Same with migration restrictions. I think, and I'm not saying that this is my favorite migration policy, but playing with ideas of if we do find this negative institutional externality, would have to be willing to confront it with thinking about how to best manage it while still maximizing either freedom of movement, if that's your end, or economic output, if that's your end goal.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's addressing the problem with a scalpel rather than a sledgehammer, in sort of metaphorical terms, it seems like.
Yeah, Brian Kaplan, right, you know, likes to call these keyhole solutions. And the new economic case for immigration restrictions, I think, is probably the hardest one to apply keyhole solutions to compared to the other problems. But this is the way I would narrow that keyhole type solution as tightly as possible, rather than just, oh, we found a negative externality somewhere, let's restrict it all over the place.
Yeah. So is the reason that it's one of the hardest ones to apply keyhole solutions to that your ability to use existing institutions to apply keyhole solutions is by assumption potentially adversely affected by the immigration?
Yeah, I think so. And just because the externality itself is destroying the gains from trade. So if your problem with immigration is giving you massive gains from trade, but there's some other external thing, you can use some of those gains from trade to address the byproduct. Here, the product itself is the negative externality. So I think that's different. Like if you say crime is the problem, it's not that, well, we don't get the doubling of global income. It's that we get doubling of global income and crime. So can we use some of the doubling of global income to address the crime? Here, it's like you don't get the doubling. In fact, maybe you got a negative. In the case, you can't just use the gains to address it. Instead, you have to, the keyhole, so most of the keyholes in like Brian Kaplan's example for problems don't involve restricting migration. They involve changing other policies to address migration. For the new economic case for immigration restrictions, to the extent that externality bears itself out in particular examples, the keyhole solution is a restriction on immigration. It's just not a blanket one all over the place. So that's what I think it makes. It's a bigger keyhole in a sense, or it's not quite the scalpel, but it's not the sledgehammer either. It's attempting to be a scalpel, but you can only be so precise with this one.
That makes a lot of sense. So are there particular directions that you think future research should go on these topics, or issues that you're excited to investigate on these issues in the future?
Well, yeah, of course. So I think, you know, more work can be done on immigrations and institutions. Certainly, I don't think my book's the end of it, but it was kind of the end of it for me. I tend to work on projects through a bunch of journal articles. And when I think I've got something more to say than I can say in any one of them, it comes together and becomes a book and my kind of best argument on it. So after I published that in 2020, I think, haven't done another one on immigration and destination country institutions since then. the new project that I'm working on right now, it's a paper with one of our graduate students here, it's under review right now, was going back to what we did in our first paper on economic freedom and immigration and turning it around and saying, well, what about destination country institutions? So this isn't really in the, it's consistent with the new economic case for immigration restrictions, but it's not the case that they make. So this would be, what if like a brain drain from origin countries erodes economic freedom in those origin countries? Well, sure, you do get the gains for the immigrants in global output, but if that makes impoverishes their country back home because it gets worse institutions, that would moderate some of those gains. This is something that's, I presented it at George Mason at a workshop there. I presented it at a bunch of conferences over this past year. Just finally got satisfied enough to send it to a journal now. But basically, we mostly find that greater stocks of immigrants living abroad are associated with bigger subsequent improvements in origin country institutions, but that it's not linear. As the stock gets bigger and bigger, the positive effect diminishes. So that there's probably a trade-off going on here and some transmission mechanism of norms and institutions from destination countries back to origin countries that's positive until too many people have left the origin country, so there's no one left there to agitate for the better institutions that the other people are talking about. It's kind of how I'd interpret it. But I think it's a relatively small literature that's out there on immigration and origin country institutions, and it's mostly on political institutions. And that could be a whole new field of inquiry that's kind of related to all of this.
That's really exciting. So in addition to the mechanisms that you articulated briefly there, do you think TIBU competition has something to do with your findings?
So we look at both immigrant stocks and immigrant flows. Immigrant stocks, I don't think is as much a TIBU mechanism one. These are stocks that are built up over decades. I think a lot more of the mechanism is the transmission of knowledge. I think flows, it could be, but flows, the empirical work on this, endogeneity problems are even bigger bitch in those than it is with stocks, because it's also established in literature stuff already and just common sense that institutions going to hell makes people try to flee the country. So if we're simultaneously looking at an immigrant flow and a change of institutions, which direction is causal? That said, we try to do some stuff empirically to deal with this and don't really get great different results. What I'll say is flows overall, we're not finding any evidence, but I think it's pretty hard to parse out the endogeneity problems from it. But one place that we do see some evidence of TIBU competition would be high-skill immigrant outflows tend to be associated with a subsequent improvement in economic freedom. Other educational groups do not. So this could be a sensitivity of origin country governments if they're losing too many high-skill people who would be their, you know, be productive and also a source of tax revenue for them, that they reform in response to that. And the fact that we're picking this up over contemporaneous flows and institutional changes says that the underlying bias is cutting against our finding of it would be bigger outflow the worse your institutions are getting if we're contemporaneously measuring outflows and changes in institutions and finding a positive. This would be like a lower bound estimate. So that's where we find some evidence for TIBU competition on this.
Excellent. So is there anywhere that listeners should go to learn more about your work or to learn more about the topics discussed in today's conversation?
Sure. You can go to my website, benjaminwpowell.com. The books are up there and available for sale. And there's links to my SSRN page, I think, where most of the articles can be found. And or you can also see for my more pop commentary stuff, if you go to Independent Institute website, independent.org, I'm a senior fellow there, and they have a listing of most of my pop writing, which includes a lot of immigration and trade stuff.
Excellent. Well, Ben Powell, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope our listeners did too.
All right. Thanks, Nathan. Always fun.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.